Aspiration prayer. May I be as loving in this moment as I can. If I cannot be loving in this moment, may I be kind. If I cannot be kind, may I be non-judgmental. If I cannot be non-judgmental, may I not cause harm. And if I cannot not cause harm, may I cause the least harm possible. Now that's an aspiration prayer I can get behind. I think that it's, for those of us, there are a lot of us now who are reflecting on the precepts, and whether we're planning on, formally receiving them or not, some of us are reading a book about them, reflecting on them, thinking about what they mean to us, which of course I want to just put out there, will be different for each of us, will be different to us from, say, the author, but nonetheless helpful to have some language to dance with and reflect on. And as we orient ourselves toward the precepts, one thing that can happen certainly is common, is that we can find ourselves beating ourselves up with the precepts too, recognizing all the ways that we are not quite reaching our aspirations. And as such, we can get kind of down on ourselves, and I just want to name that. And I find this prayer to be kind of beautiful in the sense that our job as practitioners is not to be perfect. So we can let go of that entirely. It's okay, we are going to make mistakes. We're going to hurt each other. We're going to hurt people. We're going to get swept up in our feelings and emotions and difficulties of life. This is part of what it is for us to be human beings in this world, living with each other. We're going to come into conflict. We're going to be with people who sometimes appear to us as quite unreasonable. And we're going to have to work with that. And sometimes we're going to do it skillfully, and sometimes we're going to royally mess it up. And so a big part of, I think, working with the precepts is really taking this in. It's something very humbling about the precepts. We aren't aiming toward perfection. We're never going to reach that. There's this beautiful moment in a movie called How to Cook Your Life. It's about Edward Brown, who is a teacher. I think he's a Roshi with the San Francisco Zen Center Associated Groups. And the movie's maybe from 2000 or somewhere in there, 2005. And he tells a story about how one day he was looking in through the kitchen. He's a Tenzo, has been a huge part of his training. That's the cook for retreats. And he's really into baking, and so he's written a book about that. And in this movie, he tells a story about one day he was looking into the kitchen. He saw this row of teapots. And they were sitting on the shelf, and there were these, very beautiful kind of plump metal teapots that were all banged up and dented. And he welled up with tears, and he thought, well, if they can still serve, so can I. With that context, I want to talk tonight a little bit about the paramitas, the six paramitas, which are guidance for us in our practice. And they're like a larger container, we might say, for our practice, and they're kind of compass points and aspirations. Aspirations for us dented teapots to aim toward. I hope with great compassion and forgiveness for all the ways that we fail or don't meet our own expectations or hopes. Hakuin says that the six paramitas have their source, quote, have their source in Zazen. We read that in the Song of Zazen in our sutra book. That's a thought I'd like to explore a little bit in talking about these. The six paramitas are variously translated. I'll offer a couple different translations. In The Mind of Clover, this book by Robert Aitken that some of us are reading, the first is translated as relinquishment or dana. I've also heard that translated as generosity. He suggests it's also translated as charity. I feel a kind of resonance with generosity myself, but they have slightly different implications. This implication of relinquishment is quite interesting. And it's interesting for me to consider how generosity might have its source in Zazen. And what might generosity mean? As I was sitting here before, in our last period, I was feeling so, so incredibly grateful for this shared practice, for the way that my breath was entering my body without me having to ask for it. How generous the world seemed to me. How much it seemed like I was receiving so much in just sitting here with your presence. Something about this container that magnifies practice for me, like each of you in some way living in my heart. And then it dawned on me that every breath I take, I am also exhaling and giving away. That as we sit here, we can't hold on to anything. Thoughts come and they vanish. We really are learning the art of relinquishment as we sit here together. And I also realize that my sitting was a kind of presence in your sitting. And there's a generous quality in that I was giving myself to your practice too. It wasn't only you giving yourselves to me, it was mutual. We don't really see ourselves. We often are unkind to ourselves, imagining we're not good enough, we're not generous enough. All of these things might seem like too high a bar. I can't be generous. I'd be lucky if I can, you know. We beat ourselves up. But there's something in this, right, that our true nature is to be generous. Generous with our attention. We sit here on the cushion and we pay attention. We pay attention to the sound of that bell, right? That bell rings at the beginning of the period. Ding, it's so pure. Ringing in our hearts. We're giving it all of our love and attention. I used to have a quote at the bottom of my email that by Simone Weil. It reads something like, I may have written it down, something like, I'm looking for it and I don't see it here. Attention is the purest form of generosity. We don't think of those types of things, but when we give our attention to our partner, our family, to each other in our sitting here, it's an act of generosity. Give yourself some credit. So, of course, it's also, you know, we might think about this aspirationally. It's also, you know, the giving of material goods to folks who may be in need. Or it might be thinking about not stealing, not depleting natural resources that are needed by future generations. There's so many ways of thinking about this paramita of generosity. And we can use it as a deep kind of exploration of practice and of our lives. But we can remember that its source is in our true nature, that we really can't hold on to anything anyway. So why grasp? The second paramita is translated in this book as morality, which is so interesting. I'd not seen it translated that way in other places. And of course, that denotes the precepts, which so many of us are thinking about. It's also sometimes translated as discipline. And there is a kind of discipline in practicing the precepts, in really paying attention to the ways that we can minimize harm, as we read in our aspiration prayer, and how we can be of the most benefit. It's a kind of orientation for living that makes us a little bit less self-centered. And once again, we find that the heart of our practice is, we might, for some of us, the heart of our practice is quite a simple koan, a simple question of, who am I? What is this? We enter into this sitting with a kind of curiosity. A curiosity that can help us to open beyond our self-centeredness. At some points, we might begin to realize that the stories that we make up about ourselves are just stories. That there's something bigger unfolding in our awareness that we can give our attention to. That it has a kind of beauty that draws us in, that we can deeply appreciate. And in that practice of sitting, we might open beyond that self-centeredness, that way of dualistic way of thinking of me versus you, that so often is the source of my breaking those precepts, of my causing harm, my elevating myself above others in terms of importance. So we find that even our practice, the precepts, so deeply nourished by this practice of coming together and sitting together and just paying attention. The third paramita is patience. It's actually translated as equanimity in this book, which I like even better personally, although I have no preferences. Equanimity, Aitken says, is the condition where you are not thrown off balance by anything. I think that's such an interesting definition. And it is an aspiration. For me, I love metaphors, and I love the idea of equanimity being like our rootedness in our bodies and in the moment, this, again, this very concretized practice of sitting here and being embodied is like the roots to this moment. Keep us awake and present as possible. And let's be honest. The storms of life come and we are like trees with our roots in the ground, but we get thrown and tossed and bent back and forth by that strong wind. We might think of it as an ocean in the midst of a storm, and the waves on top are thrashing, and sometimes that's just all we can see. At least with our thinking mind. And this practice of being embodied, of really staying in our physical form, even as we're tossed about by stormy seas, is like being in the depths of the ocean at the same time. There's nothing, so I think sometimes when people think of equanimity, they imagine, oh, well, it's always going to be calm seas then. I'm getting rid of all the mind waves. Well, good luck with that. Because usually, often we spend about 4 or 5 years aiming toward that before we realize, oh, shit. I don't think this is going to happen. can't quite get that technique down of no longer having a brain. We're going to think, folks. We're going to be affected by life. We're part of this world of cause and effect, and that is okay. We're dented teapots. We can still serve. Just keep your feet on the ground. Keep that sense of rootedness to the moment, even as you are blown back and forth by the storms of life. Stay steady in this practice of Zazen, even in the midst of your daily life, as best you can. And sometimes we won't be able to. But we do the best we can. The fourth is vigor. Interesting word for it, vigor. I've also seen it translated as diligence, perseverance. It's like taking our vows, isn't it? At the end of every practice, we vow. We vow with some intention to wake up. To wake up again and again. It's a life of practice. This diligence is a life of practice. And then we get blown off course and tossed about and we vow again. And we keep returning. We keep returning to Sangha. We get blown off practice. We feel terrible. I can't believe this. I'm so bad at this. And then we just take that vow again and start fresh. It's like when we lose track when we're counting the breath, we get up to 76. Wasn't I supposed to go to 10 and start? Yeah, that's okay. Just start over. Right now, it's a fresh beginning. It's like a new term. You got your grade for term one, and now it's term two. Clean slate. It's really that vow to keep practicing. The fifth is meditation. Also sometimes translated as concentration. We might think of this as the formal practice. But this formal practice, as I've been saying, I think we also, all of us, probably experiment in some way with how we can bring it into our life. This is what walking meditation is. It's like a bridge. Our practice doesn't end on the cushion. We get up. We walk in the zendo. And at Sesshin, we do work practice. Samu, where we might clean the restroom, or we might chop carrots, or rake the garden. These are ways of bringing this stillness into life. So this meditation doesn't end on the cushion. It comes forth, it springs forth into our life. And again, I'm reminded, I've said this quote so many times, but so important. You may not notice how this practice is affecting you. It's like walking in a fog, Shunryu Suzuki says, and not even noticing till you get back that your clothes are soaked through to the skin. Dalai Lama says we should practice for 5 years before we decide whether it's having any benefit. There's really something to that. Brings us back to that paramita of patience. Just keep returning again and again and again, again and again. Not just to the zendo, not just to your cushion at home, but returning to the moment again and again. And the last paramita is wisdom, or as Aitken translates it, realization. I think of this as a kind of non-dual intimacy with just what is, whatever is. Prajnaparamita Sutra calls realization or wisdom the absence of fixation. I thought that was very cool when I was sort of doing a little research for this talk. The absence of fixation. Well, you might think, gosh, I fixate on stuff all the time. We do, of course. We get stuck in our little mind loops, and I do think that they become a little looser with practice. But having said that, I mean, everything goes its own way eventually. That's something we learn for sure. I think in time we begin to see that it actually doesn't even matter if we're fixating, because fixation doesn't fixate. We can't. We actually can't hold on to anything. We don't need to make things empty or impermanent. They just are. Ultimately, there isn't anything that we need to become that is different from what we are to practice the six paramitas. They have their source in Zazen because ultimately they are simply an expression of what you already are. We just don't believe it. We're told again and again, we're already Buddhas. And we just refuse to believe it. If the true nature of reality is that it is empty, then it is already true. So the six paramitas are a wonderful kind of point of investigation. I think we can hold them as aspirations, as compass points, but hold them lightly. Because ultimately that compass point is pointing to you as you are in this very moment. Not to something outside of yourself, not to something in some future moment. If we don't realize it now, then when? How much better do you need to be? How many more things do you need to check off the list? Back to this practice of Zazen. Please sit with great faith that what you seek is already here, with great doubt that there is anything else that you need to become, and with great determination to embody the six paramitas. Thank you.